The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Rav Kook wrote in Hebrew. He did not write in English. And therefore, English translation, as all translations, is already going to lose something. It's already going to lose something. But then again, we gain much more by reading it in English than not reading it at all. And if we can't read in Hebrew, and his Hebrew is very difficult, so we do it in English. And Rav Kook is very much a poet. Rav Kook's teachings, or the Torah teachings that Rav Kook provides us, are special because he not only has a way in terms of the content of communicating what he wants to say, but the way he says it. There's so much we need to listen to the way he says things. Alright? So this is called A Thirst for the Living God. That's kind of interesting. First of all, the notion of thirst. Second of all, the notion of a living God. Is there a dead God? I mean, he could have said a thirst for God. Now, people are not thirsting God, they're thirsting for the living God. Right? Because there are people who are religious. There are people who celebrate Shabbat, put on tefillin, light Shabbos candles, eat kosher, say they believe in God. But there's something about their way that you feel that they're not with a living God. Right? A living God. You know, even, well, I won't tell you that because Ben should be sharing that with you soon anyway, so I'll let him tell you that one. But, and a thirst, what makes a person thirsty?
He tastes a bit of something.
I mean, what if he would have said a drive for the living God? What if he would have said a desire for the living God? I mean, there's, you know, alternative words, and anytime you learn a text, you ask yourself, what's the distinction between these alternative words? What does thirst provide me that suggests that drive would not suggest? Can one person speak at a time so I can hear it? Go ahead, John.
Need to it's a need.
Okay, it's a very deep need. It's also a need that comes from where? You can't have a thirst for something unless you've tasted it, right? I can't have a hunger or a thirst for Coca-Cola unless I've once in my life tasted Coca-Cola, right? So a thirst is coming from a certain memory that I have of something that I have tasted, but something that I am missing. All right. This is expressed in the Kabbalah vis-a-vis the Kabbalist notion called the breaking of the vessels. And I'm not going to go into it, but the Kabbalah talks about how God projects a thin ray of His infinite light into the vessels, which are consciousness, ourselves, whatever. And those vessels can't take the light, so they break down. There's a great explosion. And of course, the question that all Kabbalists ask, and everybody else who studies it, you don't have to be a Kabbalist to study it, is, well, why then did God give the light to the vessels? Did He not know that they would break? Why should I give you something that you cannot really contain? Right? Why should I give you something that you cannot contain? Yeah. Because it creates within you a thirst for it. Right? In other words, the Kabbalah is teaching us that every single one of us is born in this world with a metaphysical memory. Every single one of us is born with a memory of what it means to be close to the eternal, the ultimate, the infinite, whatever word you use for. Everybody comes in this world, they're already yearning. Yearning is part of being alive. Now most people are so used to earning, they forgot about the meaning of yearning. Yearning. We're really great at earning. Gotta earn a living. You gotta yearn a living. If you're not yearning a living, what's the difference if you're earning this or that amount of money? And so Rav Kook is talking about a basic idea in Judaism that says that we come in this world with a thirst, with a yearning. And we don't quite always know for what, what. You know, to me, I think this generation reminds me of an experience that I've had quite often, and you probably have too. Opening the refrigerator door, and you're so hungry, and nothing in there is what you want, and yet everything is in there. Have you done that? Where you open it up, and it's not the milk, and it's not the cheese, and it's not the tomatoes, and that. And have you closed it, and then to open it up a minute later? And of course, nothing has changed, right? It's the same stuff is in there. But what, you know? And then have you ever done it 3 or 4 times, and you're absolutely going crazy? There's nothing more painful than having a thirst and not knowing what it is that will quench your thirst. Right? And to me, that little life situation is really, I think, a life situation for a lot of people. They feel they're walking around with a thirst and they open up the refrigerator door and nothing in there seems to just be right. And you know, of course, I mean, if I'm thirsty, well, also I'll have the milk. I'll have the... It's just not it. It's just not it. And you know, why do people overeat? One of the reasons is because they're so hungry. And so then why do you overeat? You just ate, right? Because I wasn't hungry for this food. I was hungry for something so much more, and this food just doesn't satisfy me. It just doesn't satisfy me. Why am I... Because that's not really what I'm hungering for. Right? It's not what I'm hungering for. And you know what's very interesting? In Israel, and I'm not saying this is a rule or a proof of anything, but something that I found very interesting. I rarely see obese people in Israel. I mean, really obese. Really do I see that. Now, maybe I haven't gone to, Overeaters Anonymous. Maybe that's where some of them are going. I don't know. But I have not seen, rarely have I seen a person in Israel that is obese. But in America and Canada, very often I've seen, I'm talking about people who are really huge, not overweight. We're talking about really obese. I remember in Toronto, my wife and I went into Baskin and Robbins. Yes, we do that sometimes, just to use the bathroom. Now, we went into Baskin and Robbins, and there was this woman sitting there, and she was huge, right? I mean, that little Baskin and Robbins was enveloped in her hand. And I felt so sorry for this woman. Because that's really not what she wants. I mean, there might be 32 flavors. There might be 121 million flavors. That's not what we're thirsting for. But nobody knows what they're thirsting for. Or a lot of people don't. And that's what creates such instability in this world today. That people are really hungry. They're really hungry. And they so much want to be fulfilled. And they don't know what it is. But Judaism says it's a thirst for the living God. I have a thirst for a living God. The spirit cannot find its stability except in a life oriented towards God. It's very interesting. Stability. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for stability. I don't meet a lot of people who have that. What gives me stability? What is the definition of stability? Why would I want stability? I mean, that I understand. You know, you don't want to be rocking all over the place. When you're stable, you go from here to there. Right? I mean, have you seen a person who has serious balance problems? I mean, so you see a lot of people with serious physical balance problems. You see a person try and walk that line when they're picked up by the police and they were caught for drunken driving. But are we not caught for spiritual drunken driving sometimes? Have we not intoxicated our souls? And yet, of course, what leads a person to intoxication? It's precisely instability that they're feeling inside. Right? It's kind of crazy, right? I feel so unstable, so I go get drunk. I saw the other day, it just hurt me so. I saw this group of young teenagers on the street, and one girl was on the curb vomiting. Yeah, hey, let's go have a great time in Jerusalem. Is that why you've come? Right? Is that why we're here? To go to the Arizona pub? You know? There used to be a pub. There was a guy walking up and down Ben Yehuda Street. He was dressed up as a prophet. You know, with a beard and sackcloth. And he had a big sign. And he was going around going, "The end is near! The end is near! So come on down and get a beer at the prophet's pub! Open till 1 a.m. You know? Stability. People so much want stability. And yet, Judaism claims, and I didn't need to read Rav Kook to know this, and I didn't even need to learn Judaism to know this. I knew this a long time ago. That's why I looked towards Judaism. The spirit cannot find its stability. The spirit, first of all, is looking for stability, is yearning for stability. And it can't find stability except in a life oriented towards God. That's my orientation. I need an orientation, right? You walk into a program, somebody's got to tell you what's going on here, otherwise you're not oriented. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than being disoriented. And so what is my life orientation? Well, Judaism says it's God. But it's got to be life. And this is where things have broken down. Because it's not good enough that I think Jewish, I think God, I go Sunday to church, but then the rest of the week, you know, God is part of my life 2 hours a week. That's not stability. Right? I remember I was working in B'nai B'rith. And a girl said to me, I asked her if she was going to be joining us for a program that night. And she says, "No, I can't. I have an appointment with my father." I thought she was joking, so I said, "Is your father a dentist?" I thought that's what she meant. She said, "No, my parents are divorced." I said, "Oh." She says, "We have an appointment once a week to see my father." I felt very sad. I mean, I make appointments with doctors and dentists. But to make an appointment with my father, I mean, I understand practically sometimes that's what you got to do. And I appreciate that. And maybe he's the greatest dad in the world, because maybe some people get an appointment with their father once every year. I don't know, right? But to even say an appointment, say I'm getting together with my father, almost the words itself indicated her own little pain. I have an appointment with my father. You can't have an appointment with God. Because God is so much part of my life. If God is God. And if God is my boss, I have an appointment. If God is my father, my mother, my context, my air, my space, I don't have an appointment. Right? I don't. And so, the spirit cannot find its stability except in a life oriented towards God. Not only, he could have said stability and an orientation, but it's life. And that's what I find to be absolutely incredible about Judaism. That it's a life orientation. It's a living experience. It's like one of my rabbis once said, you know, in the 60s, so many people were getting high. I mean, people are getting high today too. In fact, somebody told me there's this new thing called raves. Crazy, right? You know what a rave is? Now I sound like a real hip. I thanked him. I thanked him for letting me know, so that I'm really in with it. It's like when I was working with B'nai B'rith, and there's a group of teenagers who were talking about being at the police last night. And said, "Is everything okay?" And they looked at me and said, "Man, it's a rock group." Oh, well, what a creep. I didn't know that the police is a rock group. I thought they were in jail or something. All right, so now I know what a rave is. And so a rave is they rent like some kind of warehouse, and they have a security guard in front of it, and they basically pass out acid and all other psychedelic hallucinative tickets. What?
Ecstasy.
That's it.
They
do it in the woods. Little cocktails. Anyways, and what?
You don't have it.
All right. Not be
rave wasn't one of the options what we're going to do for the next hour, so let's go on. Let's go on. It was Q&A, Rav Cook, rave wasn't on it. Right? Raves are Friday nights at Israelite. Okay. See, we've been raving for years, but it's called, I want you to know it's called chillant. Wait until you have chillant on Shabbos, man. You'll be wiped out. Okay. In the 60s, and even today, it's easy to get high. And everyone's looking to get high. But it's so easy to get high. You want to get high? Get high. It's easy. The question is, what do you do after you were high? How do you translate what you knew, what you felt? How do you translate the meaning of, so to speak, what was called ecstasy into tomorrow's job of cleaning the dishes or going to work? How do I bring the meaning of ecstasy into my everyday living? You see, Sinai is a moment. But what is incredible about Sinai is that it was translated, or it was a moment that becomes one that one can continue to draw energy from in every single day of our lives. And that's a life orientation, right? And that's really Judaism. From morning to evening, I have a way to be oriented. I'm not making appointments with my father, my mother, because I walk with my father and my mother all the time. And that's stability. And a spirit cannot find its stability except in a life oriented towards God. Why can't the spirit? He didn't say man can't find it. He could have said man can't find it, human being can't find it. Spirit can't find it, because spirit is a spark of the divine. And so spirit can't help itself to always be attracted. There's this gravitational pull. Just as my body that came from the earth has a natural gravitation towards earth, and towards earth it shall return. My soul, which comes from the divine, has a natural gravitational pull towards its source, which is the divine. So that divine within me cannot help but thirst for the divine beyond me. And the problem is, I'm in the middle. Right? Me. I'm in the middle over here. David Aaron's in the middle of that. Now either David Aaron really gets his act together, and that connection really happens, or somehow, something inside me feels so disconnected. So disconnected. And I think this is one of the big plagues of the generation. That people feel so disconnected. And they don't know why. They got a great job. Right? People love them. People are nice to them. You can't understand why they feel so disconnected. Yeah.
I understand that people feel disconnected, but I'm not sure I see that they feel that natural gravitational pull to God.
Oh, they don't. That's why there's such instability, because they don't know what they're pulled to. And they're trying to find substitutes for what we call God. The question is, what will that substitute be? You see, we gravitate to whatever we gravitate to, but it's either going to be authentic or a counterfeit. That's the way it is. It's just natural. It's natural. For instance, give you an example. Let's say you go into a handwriting analyst, right? You say, I don't know, I'm feeling I want more fulfillment. I'm feeling something stopped up inside. I'm feeling, right? He says, well, let me look at some of your latest art. You say, latest art? I'm not an artist, I'm an accountant. He says, no, I see in your handwriting you're really an artist. He says, no, I'm an accountant. My father was an accountant. My grandfather was an accountant. I mean, it's Joe, and sons and grandsons and grandsons and great descendants. I mean, this has been in my family. Well, I'm sorry. I see in your handwriting that you are in your soul an artist. You have the soul of an artist. You might have the mind of an accountant. You might be in an accountant office. I see. I want you to bring to me, right, your notes that you wrote when you were in accounting in university. The guy brings his notes and he points out to him the most incredible doodles. Right? Incredible doodles. The guy didn't even know how much art he was thirsting to do. And what's happening is he's not connected because somehow somebody convinced him that he really wants to be an accountant. Maybe he does at some level. But there's an aspect of himself that he is not giving voice to. And if you don't give voice to it, it finds other ways to express itself. Either in an authentic way, or in a partial way, or an absolute counterfeit way. I mean, since I was a kid, I wanted to go on stage and speak to people. Since I was a kid. When I was like 10 years old, I was in shul plays. I get leads, I would sing 5 solos. I mean, you know, I loved it. I thought I'd go into acting. Then I thought I'd go into music and go into rock and roll and be some kind of... I never in a million years thought I'd become a rabbi. But now looking back at it, remember learning how to read our lives backwards, it was clear to me that this is really where I wanted to be. I just didn't know why. I didn't know how. I said, yes, I'd like to go into acting, but what bothered me, but then I do other people's scripts, and then I'm doing acting that I don't even believe in. I'm saying over, I'm dramatizing ideas that I think might not be healthy for people. That's not exactly it. We can't be too far off. Somewhere in our lives, in a way that we are either consciously or subconsciously expressing, what we are is what we are. And we just find either effective ways to express it, or ineffective ways to express it. And so you're right. It's like, you know, a friend of mine, it's not exactly the correct story, but it's an important story. A friend of mine went to the Amshin of a Rebbe, great, great Hasidic Rebbe here in Jerusalem, to get in to see him. You basically have to wait till about 3 in the morning. You know, he's just a busy, busy man. I don't know when he sleeps. Really phenomenal, great Hasidic master. And she said to him, listen, I understand why I'm into Judaism, because I was always a spiritual type. But I knew a lot of people who are not thirsting for God. So he said if they would know who God really is, they would thirst. They just don't know. They just don't know. Now I kind of want to add to that, that really we kind of in our deepest, deepest recesses do know. We know that somehow, it's like, perfect example is from Bob Dylan's song, You're Gonna Have to Serve Somebody. Have you ever heard that song? It's from his, I think it was at that time, Slow Train Coming, or was it called Saved? I don't remember what it was. It was in his born-again Christian days, which thank God he is out of. But there was a period of time where, and I remember this album when it came out, a picture of a train and a guy working on the railroad, but the pick was a cross. If you looked at it carefully, so you went, oh, Bob Dylan, a Yiddish boy, Zimmerman, Robert Zimmerman, where did you go? Anyway, so he had a song in there, which was a fantastic song, called You're Gonna Have to Serve Somebody. And it's all about, you know, you're going to either serve your boss, or you're going to serve your community, you're going to serve your spouse, you're going to serve your kids. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Nobody should think that there's any other path in life other than service. Life is service. Life is service. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows that to be selfish is so lonely. Everybody knows that selfishness is the most selfless way to live your life. Because you have no sense of self when you're selfish. Right? And when you're selfless and really giving to others, you feel so full of self. Right? It's the paradox of kindness. It comes right back to you. Right? And yet, service is so natural. I'm looking to how do I serve? How do I contribute? How do I... It's just the most natural thing to want to do. To serve. And the fear of service is, on one hand, that doesn't it diminish me? You know, I don't want to be a servant to this person. But why do people want to serve their country? Because they know that by serving their country, they become part of their country. And they know that their country becomes part of them. They know that by virtue of service, they expand. Service is the most expansive way. Service is self-transcendence. And self-transcendence leads me to an even higher experience of self. Everybody's looking to serve. A life that's not founded upon service is really instability, right? Because then who am I here for? But what do you need to be here for? Anybody. It's like if you read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. So he talks about how when a person loses their sense of purpose, who or what they're here for, they die. You know? They just die. And he, you know, did studies showing how people who, when their spouses died, very often they would die very quickly afterwards. Because their whole life was in devotion to that person. It was that person that gave their lives. And unless they find something else to serve, something else to devote their lives to, they die. Right? That's his whole theory, which is very Jewish, which is meaning is an absolute criteria for life. You can take away my water, you can take away my food, but if you drain me of my meaning, I die on the spot. But what is the meaning of meaning? The meaning of meaning is that I belong to a greater context. I serve a greater reality. And in so doing, I surpass myself and participate in an even greater all-encompassing self. And the spirit cannot find its stability except in a life oriented towards God. Knowledge, feeling, the imagination, and the will in their inner and outer manifestations all condition people to center their lives in God. Now, obviously he's saying that either it's your inner or your outer, right? But basically, that's really what Judaism says. It's just natural. It's just the absolute natural. Now you have to understand how serious the implications of what he's saying. Because, of course, the critique of modern philosophy and psychology is serving God is unnatural. You're suppressing yourself. You're denying yourself. Religion robs you of your natural self. Be natural. Right? Be natural. And in fact, the foundation of paganism is precisely based on being natural. It's the deification of and the idealizing of being natural. But being natural means, listen, you naturally want to kill. You naturally want to rape. You naturally want to usurp. You naturally want to control. You are an animal. That is your nature. And if you fight your nature, you are fighting yourself. You are depriving yourself. If you remember, for those who were with us before, I quoted Mein Kampf by Hitler, where he said, yes, I'm a barbarian. Yes, we are barbarians, and we're proud of it. And I have come to free man of the conscience that the Jews have inflicted upon us. He said there are two wounds that the Jews have inflicted upon the world. A spiritual and a physical one. Conscience and circumcision. That's what he said. And it's all the Jews' fault. That's why we're all miserable. Because the Jews have made us all feel guilty with their Torah from Sinai junk. Right? When we are animals, we are barbarians. Might makes right. And if I am powerful, the jungle rules. Who said there's any other rules in the world than the rules of the jungle? Why is man to expect to be civilized when we are simply evolved apes? And as soon as we accept ourselves and who we are, we'll be happy. We'll be free. And I, Hitler says, have come to free mankind. And therefore he said the war for the control of the world is between the Germans and the Jews. He said the rest is only deception. The war was against the Jews. It was only against the Jews. Because he was of a pagan notion that nature is animalistic. And yet we are of the opinion that our nature is holy. That our inner nature, our essential nature, is holy. Our essential nature is divine. Our essential nature gravitates towards the divine. And then that is true nature. That is our ultimate nature. And so therefore, he says, knowledge, feeling, imagination, the will, and their inner and outer manifest all condition people to center their lives in God. Question is, do they do it? It's pushing us. Are we listening to what our souls are really telling us? Are we denying ourselves the natural stability of feeling part of a greater reality? Then will they be able to find their fulfillment. When they go with it, their equitable and satisfying state. And this, of course, is a contradiction to people like Freud, who saw the whole notion. I mean, Freud had some very nasty things to say about Moses, right? Wrote a book called Moses and Monotheism. And he almost blames Moses for a lot of the neurosis in the world. Right? You made all these people neurotic with these laws, you know, expecting of them to be, you know, to be angels or what, expecting them to surpass their nature. If a person should seek for himself less than this exalted state, he will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. And I think a key word here is exalted state. You deserve an exalted state. You have a right to live a life of an exalted state. And a lot of people have given up. I think a lot of the music world is that. There's so much anger in music today. I remember when I was, not Peter Himmelman, nah, right? He's doing tshuva for music. But I remember when I was growing up, one of the hit albums was by The Who, called Who's Next. And on the cover of the album was a picture of a big cement block establishment, right? And basically these guys are urinating on the rock. It's not a rock, this block, this cement block, and they're urinating, the guys from The Who, Peter Townsend, is urinating on it. And of course the title of the album is Who's Next? Join us and urinate on establishment. And of course, one of the key songs in it is called Teenage Wasteland. Right? But of course, who's one of the contributors to the Teenage Wasteland? The Who. Right? The Who. There is so much aggressiveness and so much anger and so much pessimism. And that's really the sad state, that people are angry and people are really sad, so they make it into a religion to be sad. It's like, you know, it's like good to be miserable. It's fun to be miserable, angry. That's because I just lost faith that I can be in an exalted state, that I can live a life that is in an exalted state. If a person should seek for himself less than this exalted state, he will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. Something inside me still believes that I deserve something higher, and if I don't aspire to it and put the work into it to get there, then I'll just feel like a ship tossed in the sea. I'm here, I'm there, then I'm there, I'm here. Order is an absolute essential factor in life. People need order. Confusion is worse than evil. And listen carefully. Confusion is worse than evil. Evil is something I know. And when I know something, I can fight it. Right? But confusion, I don't know. And this, the Nefesh HaChaim, the great Kabbalist, brought down that after the sin of the first man and woman, what happened in the tree of knowledge of good and bad is that good and bad became confused. And therefore, it's like two armies ready to attack each other, right? One army is wearing a bunch of white hats and the other army is wearing black hats. And as they're about to charge, a big wind comes along and blows all the hats off. And each person just randomly, quickly picks up a hat, puts it on his head. Oh, that's even worse. Because when you don't know who your enemy is, you're in greater danger. When you know who your enemy is, at least you know who your enemy is. But when you're confused and you don't know who your enemy is, when you're confused and you don't know which voice inside you is the real you, and so, without orientation, order, and that is one of the most amazing things about Judaism, is it brings order to one's life. I have prayer this time, I have Shabbos that time, I do this now, I do that. It's fantastic. I'm so happy that there's a place that I cannot eat and a place that I can. Because if I can eat any old place, it doesn't give me the same kind of order. People really do like to know what's right and what's wrong. Children are waiting for the parents to say, this you can and this you can't. And the fact that I can't is what makes what I can so meaningful. But when it doesn't make a difference, when sexuality is something I could do with anybody, whenever, wherever, then sexuality loses its taste, it loses its exalted state. What's the difference between this sex and that sex? Nothing. What makes sexuality exciting is when there's an aspect when it's forbidden. And then when it's permissible, it's just so great. You know? I mean, in the Jewish world, there's something called nida, when a man and woman do not have relations. It's precisely the time when they can have relations, which is in fact setting the stage for the time that they can. And when they can, it's so special. So when there's a yes, when there's no yes or no, when there's, you know, you can't, well, what's special anymore? Is anything special anymore? And so, I don't have any direction, I have no order, I have no system, I have no discipline. On one hand, people are so frightened of discipline, on the other hand, I need discipline. I thrive on discipline. It's the restrictions that give me so much energy. Right? I love to know that I've got to prepare a class for this time. Because I didn't know that I'd never prepare any class. Right? That's just the way it goes. I like to have a deadline. That's what keeps me alive. That's what makes my life aliveness. And so, if a person should seek for himself less than his exalted state, he will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. And that's horrifying. That's horrifying, to be so confused and so directionless and just blowing in the wind and feel that you're so easily swayed because you have no grounding. You have no anchor. You know, I want to tell you something that a friend of mine taught me. This fellow is very involved in hypnosis and meditation. He said, do you know how to prevent yourself from being hypnotized? He said, when you're sitting down, if somebody's talking to you and they're trying to hypnotize you, if you let one hand drop to the side, of course what will happen is the blood will flow to it. Alright? You'll never get hypnotized. Why? Because it will anchor you into the here and the now. Because the whole point of hypnosis is to take you out of the here and the now. He'll say, I want you to imagine you're in Bermuda. Right? You don't want to imagine you're in Bermuda because you're not. You're right here. And you're right now. I want you to imagine it's a cold day or it's a sunny day, but it's not. It's a rainy day. So as long as you have this hand limp, so to speak, hanging on your side, he said, nobody can hypnotize you because you're anchored. We need an anchor. Have you ever seen a ship at sea or like a rowboat, a camp, you know, and see it's a really stormy day and see, but you see, it's got an anchor. So on one hand, people are so frightened of an organized religion. Well, I need organization in my life. Well, why can't I pick and choose and do this and do that? But I thrive on organization. I get places through organization. I need an organized life. And that anchors me and that directs me. And that gives me just so much more. It's like a comic strip I once saw. And it was basically, here, I'll show you this comic strip. It was basically a guy, and you know, here's the comic strip. And there's this guy, and he's stuck in a box. And his entire dilemma is, I gotta get out of my box. And he finally figures out how to get out of his box. And so the last thing, of course, is he's out of his box. But of course, we know that he really is in a box. Right? He just doesn't know it because he's always in a box. It's just a different box. So one of my teachers taught me, man is free only within a box. If you have no box, you have no parameters. You are lost in space. So, what is one of the primal names for God in Judaism? Place. Space. Makom. If you remember on Passover, we say, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Blessed is the place. One of the words indicating God one of the words that suggests the divine is place and space. We understand the divine as the primordial space where in which we exist, our context. Okay? And so stormy waves raging in opposite directions will continually rob him of peace. And you know what? Especially in our generation, where people have become such experts in sales. I mean, real experts in sales. And so many people are very happy to tell you what you want. There's no lack of people on the street that are telling you, you want your hair straight. No, you want your hair curly. Now you want to dress this way. Now you want to eat this way. Now you want to live over here. Now, right? And if you don't know what you want, and they are very convincing and attractive and clever and manipulative and subliminal and whatever have you, you're not anchored in yourself. You're not anchored. You don't have a set. You don't have a frame of reference. Ah, that's the word. You need a frame of reference. Without a frame of reference, you don't know where to go. And yet when we talk about God, we're talking about the ultimate frame of reference. And then I know where I am. And I know where this stands. And I know how it relates to other things. And I know what priorities it could have and it might not have. That's the key of organization. Organization tells you, well, this is a priority and that's not because this and that. That's... Okay. And so, especially in our generation, once upon a time, it wasn't even such sales. You know, you lived in the shtetl. A guy would come in and try and sell you a watch, maybe knock on your door. Nowadays, my gosh, informationals. What do they call it? Infomercials? Unbelievable. When I go to America, I just try to get myself in touch with what's going on in America. And I'm absolutely in shock. For hours, people are actually now watching a half-hour commercial. Once upon a time, you watch 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Now, you're literally watching. Or, I mean, I can't imagine people sitting there and someone's selling you a ring. Over the phone now, just call 1-800-999. We'll send you this ring, and all you have to do is give us your credit card. I mean, what people are buying over the phone, it's unbelievable. And so, especially in the world today where everyone's got something to sell, you really need a frame of reference. You really need an anchor. You really need to say, well, what am I really thirsting? Now, of course, the whole consumer market is based on your thirsting. You're thirsting. We know you're thirsting. Do you know, a funny thing happened. There was it's amazing. There was a shopping mall that was built, and the sales were not as high as they were hoping. So they were trying to get more people into the shopping mall. So a guy came up with an idea that, the way we would increase the population coming through here is by offering free food, right? So they offered free food, and in fact, what they did is they almost doubled the population, and they almost halved their sales, and they couldn't understand it. I mean, there's now more people in the shopping mall, but there are less sales, and they realized why. Because the best time for somebody to buy something is when they're hungry. If you want to save yourself a lot of money, always eat before you go out shopping. Always eat before you, this is a good idea. You know, if you got a spendthrift husband or wife, make sure, let's go out to eat, sweetheart, just before we go out and buy something. Okay? Sales go down. Because it's all part of, it's all consumer. I'm so hungry, I'm thirsting, but what am I really thirsting for? Well, Torah says I'm really thirsting for God. And until I'm able to recognize that, and until I'm able to fulfill that in an appropriate way, I'm not talking about an idol which I call God, I'm talking about the living God. You see, that's the point. You see, a person could embark on a religious experience and still be so thirsty, because still somebody has handed them a dead God. Right? And they are still thirsting a living God. And they have not yet found the living God. And so stormy waves raging in opposite directions will continually rob him of peace. He will be thrown from wave to wave, and he will be unable to find himself. A word in a paragraph means something because it's in a paragraph. A word outside of a paragraph has no meaning. Imagine you're the word the. Feel really good, right? Hey, I'm the. Nice to meet you, I'm A. Oh, A, I'm the. Of course, the means nothing unless it's the ball, the chair, the people, right? I mean, unless it's in a context of something, unless it serves a sentence, a paragraph, a chapter, that means that the context is so much part of its personal definition. Well, if we begin to understand God, not vis-a-vis a being over there and I'm over here, but God as the all-encompassing reality, which is the way Judaism understands God, then I begin to realize how my individual reality includes God in its very definition. God is part of my definition, just as the paragraph is part of my definition. Imagine if you have the word ball in a, or you have the word bark in a sentence. It depends what sentence it's in. It could be either something on the outside of a tree, or a sound that a dog makes. Right? It depends on the context. Demonstrating how much the context defines your content. And therefore, when he says over here himself, it's not a problem for him. Because to find oneself is to find God, and to find God is to find oneself, but that doesn't mean that they're the same thing. Right? They're not synonymous, and yet they're mutually inclusive. Alright? Because God is really so much part of my personal definition, even though I'm not God, God not me, just as the word's not the paragraph's not the word, and yet the word is so much part of the paragraph, and the paragraph's so much part of the word. And so, if he should be able to immerse himself in some crude and vulgar preoccupation, well, that's what a person's going to do. I have a thirst. Well, I've got to somehow satisfy it. So they get involved with some crude and vulgar preoccupation. Preoccupation. I got to keep myself busy, 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 busy. I remember I was working in a record store, and it was a chain of stores all over the country. And it was named after the owner, you know, and he's a very famous man, a very, very wealthy man, extremely wealthy man. I was working in the store, selling albums. I loved working in the store. You really, you know, you're standing there, a guy comes and says, "Hey man, like, what's a good album?" like, how do I tell you what's a good album? I don't know, you know, well, what kind of music do you like, man? Like a rock and roll, man. Like, I love these conversations. Anyways, I did that for about a month. And so, so there was this old kind of sad individual that was working downstairs in the stocks, like cleaning records and stuff like that. And I felt really sorry for this guy, this old fellow. Well, one day a guy says to me, "Hey, listen, you got to be on your toes because the boss is here." "What do you mean the boss is here? You mean the manager of the store?" He says, "No, I mean the boss of all the owner of the chain." Now you got to understand, this guy owned not only the chain, theaters. I mean, he knows so many things. I said, "What are you talking about? I didn't see him come in." He said, "He's downstairs." I said, "There's nobody downstairs but that old guy that cleans out the records all the time." "Poor guy?" He said, "Poor guy is the owner." That's all this guy used to do. He was a workaholic. He had nothing else. His son would come in, you know, in his beautiful car. He'd come in for 5 minutes, dressed up. So his son never worked, right? But the father was like, all the time. I could try to find a preoccupation. I could try to forget my yearning and replace it by earning. I could try, right? He may succeed for a time in reducing the perspective of his life, and it will seem to him that he has finally found peace. But it will not take long, and the spirit will break out of its imprisonment, and the maddening agitation will begin to act in all its fury. That's only the first paragraph of this, right? But it is here that we will stop. Rav Kook presents the problem. The problem, he says, is, or the situation, it's not yet the problem. It's not a problem. It can be a problem, but it's a situation. It's a situation that I believe everybody's living with. It's this yearning for something more. It's this need for stability and order and organization. It's this absolute feeling of a reality beyond myself which I know is so much part of myself. And now the question is, do I find an authentic way to fulfill that in a consistent way? Or do I throw my soul a bone? Because that's really what I do. Throw a doggy a bone, make it happy for a while. It's like a friend of mine, I was talking to him and we were having this long conversation about meaning and happiness. And this was a week-long conversation. Every day we get together for a couple hours and we were arguing. And he was saying, this Judaism stuff is stupid. And I was talking about what... And at the end of this entire thing, he stops and says, "You know what, David, you're right." I am. you don't expect people to say that, right? I said, "I am." He says, "Yeah, but you know what? I have a theory. It's called the dog theory." That's what he said to me. You know how dogs kind of get a little food in this trash can and a little food in that trash can? That's my life. That's his death.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.